Good morning. Good morning. It's good to be here this morning. It's been good to participate in the Lord's Supper. Remember the death of our Lord and of our King. So the last time I was up here, preached out of Matthew chapter 16, and want to correct one thing I said in that sermon. I said in that sermon that in Matthew 16, that is where Jesus changes Peter's name to Peter. That actually happens back in John chapter 1, is when Jesus first does that, and he references it there in Matthew 16. So just wanted to make that clarification. I don't think it changes the point that I was talking about there, but I did get the timeline incorrect and wanted to correct that. Please turn to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12, we're going to read verse 3. And the sermon is not going to, we're not going to stay in Hebrews for the sermon. But there is there's some instructions given in verse 3. There's a call that the Hebrew author makes that I want us to think about and consider for the duration of the sermon. Hebrews chapter 12, beginning in verse 3. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. This morning I want us to consider Jesus. I want us to consider Jesus, the hostility he endured, the suffering that he endured on our behalf. And I'll tell you, at the beginning, I did not enjoy writing this sermon. I don't anticipate enjoying preaching this sermon, and I doubt that it's going to be a sermon that you enjoy listening to. But it was good for me to write this sermon. It will be good for me to preach this sermon, and I pray that it will be good for you to hear this sermon. So if you would please turn to Luke chapter 22, and let us begin considering Jesus. Luke chapter 22. We'll begin reading in verse 39. Luke chapter 22 and verse 39. And he, that is Jesus, he came out and proceeded as was his custom to the Mount of Olives, and the disciples also followed him. When he arrived at the place, he said to them, "Pray that you may not enter into temptation." And he withdrew from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and began to pray, saying, "Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done." Now an angel from heaven appeared to him, strengthening him, and being in agony, he was praying very fervently, and his sweat became like drops of blood falling down upon the ground. When he rose from prayer, he came to the disciples and found them sleeping from sorrow, and said to them, "Why are you sleeping? Get up and pray that you may not enter into temptation." So the first thing I want us to consider this morning is Jesus here praying to his Father in the garden. And he is begging his Father to take this cup away from him. He's begging his Father to not make him go through with this, to not make him go through with the cross. If there's any other way, please let us do it that way. He's begging his Father for that. But he says, "Not my will, but yours be done." We read of the agony that he was in. That's the word Luke uses, being in agony, verse 44. He was praying very fervently. Have you ever been in that much mental and emotional distress that you are agonized? That's what Jesus is going through here, but we get more detail about that. Luke says that his sweat became like drops of blood falling down upon the ground. And on the surface, that's kind of an odd thing to record. Sweat becoming like drops of blood. Well, is Luke maybe just talking about how it's falling off of him here? Maybe. But I believe there's another explanation that would make sense with the context. This idea of his sweat being like drops of blood. There's a medical condition called hematidrosis. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. Hematidrosis. And it's a condition where the blood vessels that supply your sweat glands with blood, those blood vessels, they rupture. And your sweat glands then exude that blood. So the blood vessels going to the sweat glands rupture, and then those sweat glands start actually sweating blood mixed with sweat. This is a condition that's often brought about by extreme mental distress. And so when Luke records here that Jesus' sweat became like drops of blood, I believe that that's literal, that he's literally sweating blood because of the extreme mental and emotional distress that he's in here in the garden. And what would cause this level of distress? And that may be kind of an obvious question, but I want us to ask the question and think about what would cause this level of distress? Well, on the surface, he's about to die an absolutely brutal death. And we're going to discuss in detail what that would look like later in the sermon. He's about to die an absolutely brutal death. But also consider this, that Jesus, God in the flesh, the eternal God through whom all things exist, is going to die. The immortal, eternal God is about to die. The only perfect human to ever live is about to experience the one thing that he should have never experienced. Death is the consequence of sin. But Jesus was sinless. He should have never experienced death, much less experienced it in the way that he's about to experience it. But nevertheless, he did for you and for me. We read in verse 47 of Luke chapter 22, while he was still speaking, behold, a crowd came, and the one called Judas, one of the 12, was preceding them, and he approached Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said to him, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? So he's in this extreme distress here in the garden, and here comes one of his closest friends to be the one who betrays him to his enemies. Judas may have been the one who betrayed him, but he's forsaken by the other 11. Mark tells us in Mark chapter 14 and verse 15 that they all left him and fled. So Jesus is now alone as he's beginning to go through this here in the garden. Turn to Mark chapter 14, please. Mark chapter 14, we're going to move now from the garden, and we're going to look at the Jewish trial that Jesus goes through. Mark chapter 14, and keep in mind the time of day, or the time of night, as it were. Because before the garden, they partook of the Passover meal, and Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper, which we have participated in earlier today. So they ate that meal at supper time. Jesus goes to the garden. He's praying there for some period of time. The rulers come to him with torches there at night and take him away, and they take him to the high priest's house. And so we are now in the middle of the night at the high priest's house. And they have verses 53 through 65 here in Mark chapter 14. We have the account of the trial that Jesus, or I should put quotes around that, the quote trial that Jesus goes through. And it's a fake trial. It's one where they knew the outcome that they wanted, and they were going to do whatever it took to get that outcome. But he goes through this trial with the chief priests and the rulers, and even though they know what they're trying to get to, they still can't get people to agree, and so Jesus almost has to help them out with the accusations against him. They ask him in verse 61, are you the Christ, the Son of God? And Jesus said, I am. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. Tearing his clothes, the high priest said, what further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. How does it seem to you? And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. Some began to spit at him and to blindfold him and to beat him with their fists and to say to him, prophesy. And the officers received him with slaps in the face. I want us to focus on verse 65 there and just take note of the unhinged hatred that the Jewish leaders have for Jesus. They're spitting on him. Something that you would not, the idea of spitting on someone is just so disgusting and gross. It's treating them as though they're not human. And that's what they're doing to their king. They're spitting on him, and then to mock him, they say, you're a prophet, so here, we're going to blindfold you and we're going to hit you. Tell us which one of us hits you. And so now the physical abuse begins. And think about that. Think about, you know, if you're, it's one thing to be punched by someone and to see the punch coming. and to be able to brace for it and prepare for it. But to be blindfolded and just be hit by multiple people all around you, this is what Jesus is going through here at the end of this trial. In Luke chapter 22, the same account of the same thing here, we get something that Mark doesn't record. Luke chapter 22, verse 60. But Peter said for the third time, "Man, I do not know what you are talking about." Immediately while he was still speaking, a rooster crowed. The Lord turned and looked at Peter, and Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had told him, "Before a rooster crows today, you will deny me three times." And he went out and wept bitterly. So Jesus, as he's been forsaken by all of his friends, Peter has now followed at a distance. But now Peter does what Jesus already told him he would do. He denies him for the third time, and Jesus turns and looks at him. And I want you to just consider what we see what Peter felt. Consider what Jesus felt as Jesus looked at one of his inner circle, even amongst the apostles, knowing that he just denied him. And just imagine the loneliness that Jesus feels in this moment. Now back in Mark, we're going to move now from the Jewish trial to the Roman trial at the beginning of Mark chapter 15. And note the timeline here in verse 1. Early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders and scribes and the whole council immediately held a consultation, and binding Jesus, they led him away and delivered him to Pilate. So we're now early in the morning on the next day. And so Jesus, he's been beaten, he's been mocked, he's been betrayed and forsaken. He's most likely been without food and water for this entire time, without sleep. So just consider the state that he's in when he's delivered to Pilate. We're told in verse 3 that the chief priests began to accuse him harshly. They began to accuse him harshly, but he stands there silently without responding to them. And just think of the mental and the emotional strength that it took to stand there and to take those harsh accusations and to not combat them. He did not stand up. He didn't explain why he was right and why they were wrong. But instead, he went as a lamb to the slaughter and as a sheep before its shearers is silent. And so we get the back and forth between Pilate and the Jewish leaders, where Pilate knows Jesus is innocent, and Pilate is trying to get Jesus off of this. But the Jewish leaders are insistent. Verse 13, they shouted back, "Crucify him." But Pilate said to them, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Crucify him." And wishing to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas for them, the murderer. And after having Jesus scourged, he handed him over to be crucified. Verse 15 there, he had Jesus scourged. He wants to take a couple of minutes to discuss this, what the scourging would have been like. Scourging is something that was done before every Roman execution, except for in the case of women, senators, and soldiers sometimes. And when someone was scourged, they would have been stripped completely naked. Their hands would have been tied to the top of a post. They would be facing the post. Their hands would be tied to the top of the post. And there would have been either one or two soldiers involved. They would have been standing one on either side, or if there was just one soldier, he would have alternated sides. And the soldiers, they would have had a whip. And this whip consisted of a wooden handle. A wooden handle, and tied to that wooden handle were strips of leather thongs of different lengths. But within these leather thongs, they had things tied within them. There were little metal balls that would have been tied within these pieces of leather. There would have been sharp pieces of bone tied within these pieces of leather. And so as the soldiers are whipping the back of this person with this whip, multiple things are going to be happening. The metal balls tied within the whips are going to be acting really as a meat tenderizer to the skin. They're going to be bruising the skin, bruising the muscles, softening it up. and the bones that are tied in, the sharp pieces of bone that are tied in, they are going to be tearing into that softened skin, ripping it apart as the whip is dragged across the back of the victim's body. And this is being done from the shoulders all the way down the legs. It's not just his back. Shoulders all the way down the legs, this is being done to our Lord. It's really a medical article. It's titled "On the Physical Death of Jesus Christ," and I would recommend reading it at some point. But there's a quote from this medical article. It was written by doctors, and they say, "As the Romans," this is the quote, "as the Roman soldiers repeatedly struck the victim's back with full force, the iron balls would cause deep contusions, and the leather thongs and sheep bones would cut into the skin and subcutaneous tissues. Then, as the flogging continued, the lacerations would tear into the underlying skeletal muscles and produce quivering ribbons of bleeding flesh. Pain and blood loss generally set the stage for circulatory shock. The extent of blood loss may well have determined how long the victim would survive on the cross." So as we consider Jesus this morning, consider what he looked like at the end of this. He has quite literally been beaten to a pulp. The entire back of his body would be a bloody mess, the skin hanging in tatters. It calls to mind Isaiah 52 and verse 14, which says, "His appearance was so marred beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of the children of mankind." So Jesus is getting to a point in this abuse where he doesn't even look like a human anymore. The abuse that he's taking on my behalf. And as the Roman soldiers, they finish scourging him, then they mock him as a king. Because remember the charge that the Jewish leaders have brought against him, that he's setting himself up to be king. He's setting himself up in place of Caesar, which is not what Jesus was doing. But that's the charge being brought against him. And so the Roman soldiers, they lean into that as they mock him. And Jesus, he's naked there from the scourging. They take this purple robe and they put this purple robe on him. They twist together a crown of thorns. And we don't know exactly what thorns were used. I heard someone describe it as akin to, I don't know if you've ever seen a locust tree and the thorns that grow off of that, but perhaps similar to that in length. But they twist together this crown of thorns, and they place it on his head, we read. And I can't imagine that they just lightly set this on Jesus' head. They probably rammed this down onto his head, this crown of thorns. But we're told also in Mark 15, verse 19, they kept beating his head with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling and bowing before him. So they ram this crown of thorns onto his head, and then they're beating it into his head with a reed. They continue to spit on him. They kneel before him. They say, "Hail, King of the Jews." And then we're told, verse 20, after they had mocked him, they took the purple robe off him, put his own garments on him, and they led him out to crucify him. And I want us to consider this. When they took the purple robe off of him, remember what his back is like at this point. The bloody mess that it is, and it's likely that purple robe was clinging to his back, and they rip it off of him, ripping open the wounds that may have begun to heal or to congeal. They rip that robe off of him, put his own clothes on him, and they lead him out to crucify him. Verse 21, they pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. So this idea of Jesus, he's now going to walk from the place of judgment outside the city to Golgotha, where he will be crucified. And contrary maybe to how artists would render it today and how we think about it, he's most likely not carrying the entire T-shaped cross on his back. Most likely what he's carrying is the horizontal crossbar. They would have taken that crossbar, and they would have laid it across his shoulders, tying it to his arms. And his crossbar probably would have been 75 to 100 pounds. They placed it across his shoulders, and remember the state of his shoulders, the state of his back at this point, after the scourging. But they lay that across, they tie it to his arms, and he begins to walk to his death, carrying the instrument of the death. But it seems as though Jesus, he couldn't physically bear the cross, which makes sense considering what he's gone through already to this point. And so they press this man named Simon into service, and he carries the crossbar the rest of the way. Now please turn to Matthew 27 as we consider the actual crucifixion. Matthew 27, and I want to read this whole section beginning in verse 33. Matthew 27, verse 33. And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull, they gave him wine to drink mixed with gall, and after tasting it, he was unwilling to drink. And when they had crucified him, they divided up his garments among themselves by casting lots. And sitting down, they began to keep watch over him there. And above his head, they put up the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." At that time, two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. And those passing by were hurling abuse at him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." In the same way, the chief priests also, along with the scribes and elders, were mocking him and saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him now come down from the cross and we'll believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he delights in him. For he said, 'I'm the Son of God.'" The robbers who had been crucified with him were also insulting him with the same words. Now from the sixth hour, darkness fell upon all the land until the ninth hour. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of those who were standing there when they heard it began saying, "This man is calling for Elijah." Immediately one of them ran, and taking a sponge, he filled it with sour wine and put it on a reed and gave him a drink. But the rest of them said, "Let us see whether Elijah will come to save him." And Jesus cried out with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. So this is the account of our Lord's crucifixion. And I want us to consider several things as we examine this account. First, verse 34, we're told that they gave him wine to drink mixed with gall, but he was unwilling to drink it. What this would have been, this wine mixed with gall, this would have been a mild pain reliever, not something to where he wouldn't have felt anything on the cross, but that's what this was. This was a mild pain reliever, but Jesus rejects it. He chooses to reject that pain reliever and instead bear the full punishment for my sins. In verse 35 of Matthew, it says, "And when they had crucified him, they divided up his garments among themselves by casting lots." In Mark 15, verse 24, it says, "And they crucified him and divided up his garments among themselves, casting lots for them to decide what each man should take." Luke 23, verse 33 says, "When they came to the place called the skull, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right and the other on the left." And in John 19, verse 18, it says, "There they crucified him, and with him two other men, one on either side and Jesus in between." There are relatively few words spent describing this crucifixion. They simply say, "when they crucified him." But for all of the times that we've read these verses, this is what's being described here, what's not even being described, what's being mentioned here is a very foreign practice to us. This doesn't happen where we live today. We've never seen people being crucified on the side of the road as we walk into a city. So I want us to take time to consider what is being mentioned, what all is encapsulated in these brief verses. So still in Matthew 27, verse 35, the latter part of that verse says, "They divided up his garments among themselves by casting lots." So he would have been stripped of his garments again ripping open any wounds that may have begun to scab over. He's there completely naked. And then they would have taken the crossbar off of Simon's back. They would have put that crossbar on the ground. They would have thrown Jesus to the ground, getting dirt and all kind of rocks and things in those wounds. They would have thrown Jesus to the ground. They would have stretched his arms out across that crossbar, and then they would have nailed his arms into that crossbar there on the ground. They would have nailed them in using spikes, probably 5 to 7 inches long and tapered to a very sharp point. And these spikes most likely would have been driven through his wrists. And you might say his wrists, not the palms. Because again, artist renderings and things today, we think of palms. But even in John 20, I think it's where it comes from. In John chapter 20, after the death of Jesus and after his resurrection, we have Thomas who's saying, you know, unless I see the wounds in his hands, I'm not going to believe. And so I think that's where we get this idea, maybe that's through the hands, through the palms specifically. But in this time, when people talked about the hands, the wrists were included in that. The wrists were considered a part of the hand during this time. And various archaeological evidence and things like that indicate that it was most often they were nailed through what we would call the wrists. And so as he's thrown to the ground, these spikes are driven through his wrists, and they would have been driven, the location they would have been driven, they would have gone in between some of the bones there in the arms and in the wrist. And remember, not a bone was to be broken, and this would be consistent with that. The nails, the spikes would have been driven through in between some bones, and then those bones would then support the weight of the body when he's lifted up and hung on that cross. So those bones are resting against the nails driven through, and that's what's keeping Jesus up there. But as if having a spike driven through any part of your body would not be painful enough, there's a large nerve in the wrist. There's a large nerve in the wrist right where the spike would have been driven through. It's called the median nerve, similar to the ulnar nerve. And I'm not a medical person, but I am familiar with the ulnar nerve, and everyone in here is as well. We call it the funny bone there in our elbows. And so and you think about when you hit your funny bone on something, that sharp electric jolt of pain you get radiating down your arm. Well, it's a similar nerve that's there in the wrist, right where the nails were driven through. So imagine having a metal spike nailed right through the nerve there at your funny bone. That's what happened to our Lord when the spike was nailed through his wrists. One doctor described it this way. He said, you know, thinking about the funny bones, since that's what we're familiar with. He said, imagine holding that nerve in a pair of pliers and then squeezing it. That's what it felt like for Jesus the whole time that he's hanging there on that cross. That immense pain radiating through his arms for 6 hours. The pain of the cross was so bad that the Romans had to invent a new word for it. We're familiar with the word, and you may have heard this before. The word is excruciating. The word excruciating literally means out of the cross. The pain that Jesus went through on the cross, the pain that people went through on the cross and Jesus our Lord went through was so indescribable that they had to come up with a new word to describe it, excruciating. So now Jesus is nailed to that crossbar on the ground, and now several of the soldiers would have then picked him up, placed the crossbar on the upright part of the cross that would have already been there in the ground. They place him on there, and they nail his feet to the cross, which most likely would have crushed more nerves in his feet. They nail his feet to the cross, and now he's hanging there. And he's hanging there, the weight of his body is being supported again by the bones in his arm on those spikes. And it most likely would have been, you know, kind of in a Y position like this, with his hands up above his head in a Y position. And in that position, as the arms are taking the full weight of the body, and as gravity takes effect, most likely the shoulders would have been dislocated, and potentially the elbows as well would have been dislocated as he's hanging there on the cross. Calling to mind Psalm 22 and verse 14, where David says, "All my bones are out of joint." The main contributor to death on a cross was not actually blood loss, but instead it was asphyxiation or suffocation. The victim slowly becomes unable to breathe like they need to. Because you see, the way that a person's body hung from the cross, the way that the body hung from the cross interfered with the normal process of breathing out, of exhaling specifically. It's not that he couldn't breathe in, it's that he couldn't breathe out. Because as you're hanging there from the cross, the weight of the body is being distributed towards to the chest muscles and the muscles within your chest that are used to breathe out. And it keeps them from working like they're supposed to work. And so as that happens, people are they're breathing very shallowly, and carbon dioxide, CO2, is building up within the blood, which would in turn lead to extreme muscle cramps that would further hinder breathing. And so in order to exhale properly on a cross, the weight has to be taken off of the chest. It has to be taken off of the chest so that the person can breathe out again. And so this means that the person has to push up using their feet to take some of that weight off of their chest just so they can breathe out. The arms would go more from a Y position, closer to a T position as they're pushing up. And think about what all this would involve. The nails have been driven through both feet and the nerves there. And so Jesus has to apply pressure in order to push off of that nail that's driven through his feet and lift his entire body. And remember the state of Jesus' back from the scourging. He'll be rubbing up against the upright section of the cross as he pushes himself up to exhale. And I highly doubt that upright section of the cross was a piece of finely sanded wood. So he's scraping his shredded back across the rough cut wood. His arms are out of joint as they're being bent. His wrists will be rotating around the nails that have been driven through that median nerve. All of that just so he can breathe out. Just so he can breathe out. And after he exhales, after he gets up there and he breathes out, his body most likely is just going to drop back down to the hanging position. He most likely was not able to lower himself back down in a controlled manner. So just consider how jarring that would have been as he drops back down to the lower position, only to have to do this all over again the next time he needs to breathe out. He's on that cross for between 3 and 6 hours. He's breathing like that for hours on end. It's very likely in the hours that he's hanging there on the cross that bugs could have crawled into his wounds. In Matthew 27, verse 39, it says, "And those passing by were hurling abuse at him, wagging their heads and saying, 'You who are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you're the Son of God, come down from the cross.'" And we read earlier how the chief priests were also mocking him, and the robbers who were crucified with him were mocking him. Everyone surrounding Jesus, these strong bulls that have surrounded him, as David says in Psalm 22, they're mocking him constantly for the hours that he's up there on the cross. His creation, those who are made in his image, are treating him as though he is something less than human. Think of it as he's hanging there on the cross again for hours on end. His mother is there in the crowd, and he sees his mother. He speaks to her at one point. So he sees his mother, and he's seeing the anguish that she's going through as she's watching her son be killed in this manner. And again, all of this for hours. We can read each of these accounts. We can read each of these accounts just in a matter of minutes. But the actual experience, the actual thing happening here would have been played out over an extended period of time until ultimately Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And that's important because Jesus gave his life up. It was not taken from him. He gave it up willingly. He yielded it up. He gave it up willingly, and he gave it up willingly for each person in this room. Because all of us, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, but the Lord has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him. It's Isaiah 53 and verse 6. Paul says in Romans 5 and verse 6, "For while we were still helpless, at the right time Christ died for the ungodly." I don't have a specific application this morning. Sometimes I'll be specific in some of the things that I call out. I don't have any specific application this morning. I simply want us to consider Jesus and then consider ourselves. Because the death that he died that we've discussed this morning, that death that he died was the punishment for my sins. It's the punishment for my sins. And because he died, and thank God because he rose from the dead 3 days later, I can now experience that. Paul talks in Romans 6 that in baptism I can die with him and then be raised up a new man because of this, because of what we've looked at this morning. So the question is, what am I going to do with this new life that Jesus has bought for me? What am I doing with this new life that Jesus has bought for me? Please turn to Hebrews 13. We began in Hebrews 12 with the call to consider Jesus and the hostility that he endured. I want us to close in Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13, beginning in verse 12. Therefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people through his own blood, suffered outside the gate. So let us go out to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. For here we do not have a lasting city, but we are seeking the city which is to come. And so I ask you this morning as we close, are you going out to Jesus? Are you going out to him, bearing the reproach that he bore for you? Are you willing to do that for him? Consider him. Consider what he went through. Consider the pain, both physical, mental, emotional. Consider the pain that he went through, the death that he died for you. And ask yourself, where am I not going out to him? What part of my life am I not going out to him, bearing the reproach, bearing what he's called me to bear? What am I doing that he's calling me to give up? What am I not doing that he's calling me to do? How can I look at him hanging on the cross, and how can I tell him, no, I'm not willing to give that up. I'm not willing to give that up. I'll give up most things, but give up everything, take up my cross, follow you in everything? I can't, not that I can't, I won't do that. I want us to consider Jesus. I want us to consider Jesus and consider ourselves and consider the choices that we make in our lives and live lives that glorify God, that glorify Jesus for the love that he showed us on the cross that day. If you have not given your life to Jesus, if you have not submitted to him, if you have not died with him in baptism, we beg you to do that. To recognize what he's done for you and to submit to him in baptism. If you have done that, but you're struggling with imitating him, with following him, with bearing that cross daily, we'd love to encourage you and help you in that. However we can help you with that, please let us know. You can come forward now as we stand and as we sing.